Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
And hello, welcome to Be the Media. Folks, you are listening, of course, to CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. You don't want to change your dial, as here we are at the top of the show. I'm Marian Vanderzon. I'm here in the studio with Neil Scobie and Emily Post. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
And so, folks, we have a lovely focus on music for the first two-thirds and beyond of the show. First up on Be the Media, we have Dimitri Demirs. He's co-owner and co-founder of Atomic Productions Limited, and he joins us to talk about independent concert promotion. Atomic produces the annual festivals Rock the Shores and Rifflandia, as well as an average of 150 plus concerts per year in venues with capacities ranging from 200 to 7,500.
Then Neil Scobie joins us to talk about the evolution of the DJ, tools used, and influence on popular music. We'll talk about how technology and innovation have impacted DJ culture in the past, present, and future, and particularly the propensity for experimentation that has allowed new directions and musical genres to emerge.
And folks, we're going to be right back with Dimitri Demirs from Atomic Productions. This is Hannah Georges and the track This Is Good, the title track, and Atomic Productions is promoting this show that is upcoming in about a month's time. More on that soon.
We came, we lovers. And
be lovers in the sun. We can play around like we're young, cross our hearts and hope to die, swear by stars and light the night, and turn the lights down, and we'll start to dance and get close, and you'll hold on to my hands, and I can't help but feel like this is, I can't help but feel like this is good.
And folks, that was Hannah Georges with the title track, This Is Good. She's playing at the Upstairs Cabaret on April 25th. And of course, that show, amongst many, many others, is being promoted by Atomic Productions. I have on the phone with us today Dimitri Demirs. He's the co-owner and co-founder of Atomic Productions Limited. And Atomic is an independent concert promotion company founded in 2000 with a mandate to bring a diverse array of national and international talent to the Greater Victoria Market. Atomic produces the annual festivals Rock the Shores and Rifflandia, as well as an average of 150 plus concerts per year in venues with capacities ranging from 200 to 7,500. As we chat, folks, if you want to check their website, you certainly can, www.atomic, and that's the French spelling, productions.com. Again, atomicproductions.com. Dimitri, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure to have you. I guess to start, Dimitri, I mentioned by saying that you're co-owner and co-founder of Atomic, or Atomic, as people prefer. So who's your partner?
My partner's Nick Belasco. Nick and I have been friends since elementary school, and we started promoting shows, all-ages punk shows, in high school, actually. We kind of grew up on kind of going to punk shows when we were about 14, 15 years old. And then things kind of got a little quiet on that front in Victoria, and we decided to figure out if we could do it ourselves.
And so you've expanded from punk rock into all kinds of genres. I mean, you really don't limit yourself in terms of genre anymore.
There probably isn't a genre we haven't covered at some point.
Yeah. You've promoted, I mean, as I said off the top, you know, 150 plus concerts per year. So I'm loath to, you know, provide a list, but I do want to let people know just the extent of the acts you're working with. So, I mean, it's everybody from, of course, you know, the bigger names like Tragically Hip to The Flaming Lips to Mother Mother, Cake, Hey Ocean, Long Walk, Short Walk, Short Dock, excuse me. And this is, of course, only to mention, you know, it's just very much the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we could probably spend 10 minutes just listing bands that you've promoted, or listing concerts, rather, that you've promoted. So, you know, you talked about how you started out promoting smaller shows and grew over time. What was that shift when you took a break and then you kind of came back to it with Atomic Productions? What was that shift like? How did you evolve? How did you start expanding into the bigger shows?
Well, basically, like I said, Nick and I started, you know, doing small sort of grassroots level shows when we were in high school, and we kind of continued on with that into our 20s, and actually we sort of got really involved with electronic music in Victoria, sort of in its heyday in the 90s, and then we ended up sort of forming a union with Gary Van Buskirk, who was a founder, one of the co-founders of Harpo's Cabaret.
Mm-hmm. Which is now...
Some of your older listeners may remember Harpo's, who was a pretty legendary live Victoria live venue in Victoria.
And still carries on today as the Upstairs.
Yeah, it does, yeah. Actually. It's very true. And so... He had formed a company post-Harpo's called T-Bone Productions with another sort of Victoria live music stalwart, Marcus Pollard. And then eventually Marcus decided he wanted to focus on other things, and Gary made a move to form a new company with us. So we formed Atomic Productions in 2000 with Gary, and... You know, he brought a lot of experience to the table, and Nick and I brought a lot of youthful energy to the table, and it was a good combination. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, Atomic Productions is really Nick and I. Gary's gone on to do other things. And, yeah, we've just sort of been tenacious, been patient, and been resourceful, and we're still continuing to build our company, really.
Mm-hmm. So, Dimitri, take us through it a little bit. I mean, you know, this is a show on media, and we talk about, you know, what happens in behind. And I think a lot of people, when they hear about a promotions company, they would think about it in terms of seeing posters up, you know, around the city, around an urban space, but they may not know exactly what else is involved. So take us through what it means to promote a show.
Oh, well, they're kind of, it's a pretty multifaceted job description, actually. I mean, you're going to be dealing with anything from booking the show, you know, negotiating with agents, negotiating with venues, negotiating with suppliers. You're going to be putting that show on sale, managing all the ticketing, getting all the promotion out that you can, you know, making sure people know about it. And ultimately, you're going to be producing the show. So you're going to be handling all the logistics of making sure that the act in question gets on stage and puts on a great show for a bunch of great people that are watching.
How would you match a particular concert, a particular act, to a specific venue? I mean, you know, you've got everything from the Alex Goulden Hall to, you know, 919 to, I mean, you've got a big range in terms of, you know, sit-down theaters right through to, you know, festivals and whatnot. So how would you...
Well, it's, you know, it's a number of factors. You know, I mean, probably first and foremost is, you know, how many people do you estimate are going to be in attendance for the show? How many people can that act draw? You know, so that's going to immediately determine the size of the venue. You know, it could be anything from a 100-capacity nightclub all the way up to, you know, the arena, Save On Foods Arena, and larger.
Mm-hmm.
Then beyond that, what you sort of get into is kind of musically, what is the band about? Do people want to dance? Do they want to sit? Do they want to listen? Do they, you know, what's the environment that they, you know, that people are going to favor watching the act in question in? So, you know, some bands are very at home in nightclubs, and other bands, you know, it really makes sense to put them into theaters.
Right. And you're also building long-term relationships. You know, I've noticed over the years that you'll have, for example, bands playing at Rifflandia, but then you will take these bands, you know, for example, Long Walk Short Doc. I know that, you know, he played at the Rifflandia Festival, and you just had a show with him at Sugar Nightclub just, I think it was last Friday, I believe. And so you're essentially building relationships with these artists, right, over a longer period of time.
Yeah, no, it's very important. I mean, and those are probably the artists we really prefer to work with, are the ones that are going to have a long lifespan and aren't just going to be a flash in the pan. So
let me interrupt there, Dimitri. How do you decide that? How do you choose who you're going to work with?
Well, I mean, musically, you can kind of see what's going on with some bands and just kind of be like, you know, this might be sort of hot right now and gone pretty quick. Other bands, you kind of feel like this kind of feels like it's going to be a career band. You can also look at, you know, the types of decisions they're making, you know, how often they're touring, you know, how they're promoting their records, you know, kind of what their overall strategy seems to be.
Right. And then do you tend to also, I mean, how much of a nod do you have, I guess, to the local Victoria scene? You know, I mean, I notice sometimes you have, you know, or often you'll have local bands, for example, opening up. And that's not exclusively the case. But
well, we're always happy to put local bands on as openers for shows. We only get really so many opportunities because for the large part, we're working with touring bands, bands that are sort of, you know, sort of doing things on kind of a national or international level. And usually, I'd say probably maybe 80% of those bands are touring with a smaller band as support. Usually, kind of what happens is there's the band that's headlining is taking out a band that's on the same record label as them, but smaller or on the same agent, or their agent has a smaller band on the roster that he needs to get exposure for, kind of a thing. So most of the time we don't really get to put locals on as a support for bigger shows because of that, but when we can, it's awesome. I love to give local bands opportunities.
Right. And then do you select them, you know, based on the buzz that they have around Victoria or Vancouver Island, as the case may be?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, you're going to be paying attention to that as a concert promoter, but, you know, usually if you're picking out a band that's a support band, you know, it gives you, you're not really relying on the support act to sell the tickets to the show. So, you know, it gives you a little bit more freedom to pick bands you just kind of like.
Right. And take a chance, as it were.
Yeah,
excellent. Okay, so obviously it's mostly promoting, so I guess I want to touch on that. I mean, there's, you know, traditional types of promotion, of course, and, you know, everything from posters to, you know, articles and advertisements in print newspapers, but as we all know, much of promotion has moved online these days. And so I guess I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about that in terms of your approach with Atomic Productions. Do you tend to use both traditional modes of promotion from traditional media as well as social media, or what's your goal? How do you move forward in that regard?
Well, you know, promotion, advertising in general is kind of, you know, it's kind of about putting pieces of a puzzle together as opposed to it just being focused in one specific area. So some, you know, we certainly have a strong online presence. You know, we have our website, our social media, various listings, targeted geo-specific Facebook campaigns, email newsletters, you know, all of that sort of thing. But we also still run print ads and utilize radio whenever possible and, you know, make sure those posters are out on the street.
Yeah, well, it's huge. Do you have any sense of what the response is from using a different medium? Like, do you have any sense of how many people are coming in through, for example, your a Facebook page versus the posters versus ads in Monday Magazine?
Well, you know, it's every show's a little bit different, and the crowd for every artist is a little bit different. So it really depends on the show. Certainly, you know, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of an obvious fact that, you know, there's younger kids that are, you know, used to responding to online promotions and advertising more readily than older demographics who are probably picking up Monday Magazine and Times Colonist and mm-hmm. listening to the radio to and from work and whatnot. But, you know, you really... You got to think sort of about, you know, your entire scope when you're marketing. You can't just really focus on one thing. You're going to catch different people with different mediums for different reasons.
Right. So you're trying to be as broad as possible, generally every time.
Yeah. But there's plenty of ways to advertise online that, you know, are quite interesting.
Can you give us an example?
But it's not really. I still don't really totally feel that it's the whole story at this point.
Right. So you mentioned that there's interesting ways to advertise online. Can you give us an example?
There's plenty of social media opportunities. I mean, you know, that gets kind of bantered about as a catchphrase quite often. Mm-hmm. And then also there's a lot of things you can do through your ticketing companies. They're gathering a lot of data on who your consumers are all the time. And there's just a lot of data you can gather. You can see how many people clicked on this link, how many people viewed that, how many people responded to this, you know, in a very...
immediate way.
Well, yeah, very immediate statistical manner. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like you can't really tell how many people looked at your poster, but, you know, people did look at your poster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, folks, I'm speaking with Dimitri Demirs. He is the co-owner and co-founder of Atomic or Atomic Productions Limited in Victoria, Greater Victoria region primarily. Not only do they bring over 150 concerts per year across venues in Greater Victoria, but also certainly you've been bringing, Dimitri, the annual festivals Rock the Shores and Rifflandia. And Rock the Shores is a little bit newer, but certainly Rifflandia has, you've met with a lot of success. You've had a lot of sellouts at Rifflandia. It's been great. Maybe just to close, Dimitri, I wonder, I know you've been involved in promoting hundreds of shows and you've been, you know, working with Atomic Productions for, well, coming on 13 years now. Give us a highlight as we close the interview, if you would.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's you're definitely not the first person who's asked me this, but it's kind of hard to quantify. I think what really sums it up for me, though, or kind of the best way I can put it is, you know, I'm a fan. I'm a music lover. I'm a record collector, and I've been such since I was maybe, you know, 13, 14 years old. And what's always exciting is when you get to work with somebody who you've been a fan of since you were a kid, and you grew up listening to, and then, you know, when you actually get to shake their hand on a professional level backstage, it's fun, it's interesting, it's cool. It's always really interesting to meet those people face to face and chat for a sec.
Dimitri, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was great to be on your radio show.
Folks, once again, I've been speaking with Dimitri Demirs from Atomic Productions. Again, they do promote hundreds of shows within the context of one-off shows and festivals per year. You can go and you can check them out at www.atomicproductions.com to get a sense of all the shows, but certainly just in the next month and a half, everyone, they're involved in promoting everyone from Mindle Beach Markets to Diamond Rings to Leonard Cohen to Martha Wainwright and Stars and many, many more.
Every road home is long. He had a map that he bought for the price of a song. He had a reason to go there and a warm place to stay. And when it came time to leave, it was never the right day. Like he was blind, up at 5 in the morning, every breath was a storm. It's so cold in this country, you can never get.
You are listening to Be the Media here on CHLY 101.7 FM. That was The Stars with the track The North, and The Stars are playing Friday, April 5th at the Alex Goulden Hall, and the show is being promoted by Atomic Productions. We were just speaking with Dimitri Demirs. Folks, I want to let you know, too, about an event that is happening this weekend, this Friday and Saturday, so March 1st and 2nd. It is a V-Day theater event. It's called Any One of Us, Words from Prison, and it's happening at 7:30 in the evening. And if you want more information about this, we did a full interview last week with the director and some of the actors of the show, but certainly it is a play that was co-written by Eve Ensler and 15 women at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. And it is, as I mentioned, playing at the Nanaimo Centre stage this Friday and Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m. Any One of Us, Words from Prison. And it looks like it's going to be a raw collection of voices from women who have been writing from the place, the perspective of being in prison, and also moving towards healing, understanding, and change in terms of changing policy and the treatment of incarcerated women. So once again, that is this Friday and Saturday evening.
I never let the mic magnetize me no more, but it's biting me, inviting me to rhyme. I can't hold it back, I'm looking for the line. Taking off my coat, clearing my throat, the rhyme will be kicking in till I hit my last note. My mind remains defined, all kind of ideas. Self-esteem makes it seem like a thought took years to build, but still say a rhyme after the next one. Prepared, never scared, I'll just press one. And you know that I'm the soloist, so Eric B, make a clap to this.
Folks, welcome back to Be the Media. It is a great pleasure that I now have to interview Neil Scobie. Neil Scobie, of course, is the technical producer and co-host of this show. He's also a fourth-year digital media studies student at VIU. And before returning to school in 2009, Neil spent many years in the audio industry as a radio and club DJ, an audio engineer and music producer, for which he was twice nominated for a Juno Award. Some of his interests include media history, propaganda, advertising, and the appropriation of technology to create new art forms. And so today, Neil, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marianne. I'm a longtime fan of the show, so thanks. thanks for having me on.
Yes, and intimately involved with it. So Neil, of course, we wanted to do this because you are going to be presenting at a conference in Quebec, in Montreal, I believe. Can you remind me, what is the conference?
Sure. It's called the QUEUC, Quebec University English Undergrad Conference. And it's basically for undergrads across the country in the English discipline of English or similar in the arts and humanities, I guess, and media studies is in that group, to present papers that they've been working on and would like to share. It's a conference like any academic conference where it's basically a place for people to network and share ideas. And I submitted a paper on the last day, very Neil Scobie-like, and they said, they liked it and they invited me
Fantastic.
Out. So yeah, it all happened very fast, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's a great paper. I've read it.
Thank you.
So just to give folks the full scoop here, it's entitled, It's Not in the Manual, Digital Technologies, Innovation, and the Future of the DJ and Popular Music. So of course, it is very much about DJ culture, very much about music. And what you're doing in the paper, I mean, you know, as an overview for people, is you're looking at the shift from analog to digital music formats. But more than that, you're looking at the effects that this technology's had on DJ culture, including the incorporation of new tools that have been coming along from the turntable onwards. So maybe to start, can you give us an example? When we're talking about DJ culture, some people, of course, they're not that knowledgeable about DJ culture. So give us an example of a tool, a specific tool that has been widely used in DJ culture, and for what purpose might it have been used for?
Okay, well, first and foremost, it's the turntable, and specifically a model called the Technics SL1200. Turntables were central to DJing in the 60s in like dub reggae culture. Also, a gentleman by the name of Pierre Schaeffer did experimental music called Musique Concrète, which used the turntable. But in the 1970s, this heavy-duty edition of the turntable, the Technics 1200, was powerful in the sense that records were easily manipulated on the turntable.
Okay, what do you mean for the layperson,
sure,
easily manipulated?
My expertise is in hip-hop, and so what I talk about is how the hip-hop DJ took the turntable and used it in a way that it hadn't been used before. DJs were playing records, but what the hip-hop DJ did, starting with DJ Kool Herc, Grandmaster Flash, African Bombada, this is all in the South Bronx in the early to mid-70s, what they were doing was playing just bits of the record. So they would just play, say, 20 seconds of a particular part of the record. It was called the break, mm-hmm, the high point of the record, usually maybe just a drum solo or like a very high energy part of the record. And that that was basically the backbone of what would become hip-hop, was these DJs, before there was even MCs or rappers. They were DJs playing just bits of the record. So just the fact that they weren't playing the whole song, dropping the needle, playing the whole song, fade out, play the next song, because that's what DJing was on the radio and in nightclubs in New York and otherwhere.
And this is part of what necessitated having two turntables, because if you're only playing a 15-minute break, if you will, then there's a lot of moving back and forth.
Yeah, 15-second or 20-second, very short.
Sorry, not minute second.
No, yeah, you needed two, and that facilitated being able to play, you know, just a bit of the record. And then as soon as that bit was over, you played the next bit. And it was done with the help of a mixer. So you could play one record at a time and turn the volume off on the other record as you played the second one. And then back and forth.
Yeah. And so this would affect then how a DJ performs.
Yes.
In what way particularly?
Well, what began with DJs like Kool Herc, this gentleman's actually credited with being the first hip-hop DJ. They've documented his first party in the Bronx, Sedgwick Avenue. The building's still there and everything. And what he did, I mean, it's looked at now as maybe, I don't want to say clumsy, but it was the very beginning of just dropping the needle on where he knew that the break was. But later DJs like Grandmaster Flash brought precision into it. He would use headphones to be able to cue the next record, listen to the next record, and Grandmaster Flash was all about timing. And I'm sure the listeners may have actually heard the name Grandmaster Flash, because his name has actually transcended hip hop, and he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, for instance. And so what Grandmaster Flash brought to the equation was precision and timing, and that was the forerunner to the loop, the digital appropriation of the record, which came later in the 1980s.
Yeah. And okay, so this is really interesting, because if we come back to the Techniques 1200, mm-hmm. when the Techniques 1200 was put out, I'm making an assumption here, I don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, I assume that it wasn't put out to be used in this way.
No, and that's what's so fascinating to me. And that's why the first half of my essay is called It's Not in the Manual. You need to close the manual, basically, right?
Yeah.
You can't, if you're going to do something innovative, if you're going to create something new and innovative, you've got to close the manual. And so the makers of the Techniques 1200 could have even imagined that the turntable would have been used in that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
Or repurpose.
Or repurpose, rather, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's really thinking out of the box.
Yeah.
And it's throughout musical history, from the microphone to the electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, and beyond. I mean, it certainly happens, of course, as I'm a fan of radio, so it certainly happens with radio transmitters, right? People
mm-hmm.
creating treasure hunts or using them as, sound systems across a city, but using them in ways that were completely unintended. But it's exciting when people are experimenting with technology and repurposing it, if you will, in new ways, because of course then new things happen. And so, and this is one of the things that you touch on too, is in terms of genres of music, that the way that this turntable was used then led to particular styles that started to open up. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. What happened was that in the mid-1980s, hip-hop records began in 1979. And what they were doing was they had a live band replay the rhythms that were played on the records. So it went from the DJ playing the break beats, to a band replaying the breaks, the beats and bass lines. And then in the early 80s, it was then drum machines. But then what happened in about 1985 or 1986, DJ by the name of Marlon Williams, his name is, he took a digital sampler. His idea was to take individual pieces off the record, like a kick drum, a snare drum, the boom, snap, and the hi-hat, and take those bits and pieces of records and rearrange them into new formats. The song that we came in with, it's called Eric B. as President, by a rap duo called Eric B. and Rakim, produced by Marley Marl, and it's one of the first records that actually used sampled drum sounds rearranged into a new drum pattern. It sounds so simple now,
mm-hmm.
but in 1985, 86, this was really, really groundbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And hip hop was one of the first art forms, if not the first art form, to take digital media and use it in a way that they were reappropriating, like taking something and reappropriating it. It was new, but they were using these digital technologies in ways that they weren't intended.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody at Akai or Emu, the Fairlight, the makers of the early samplers, could even have dreamed that that's, you know, some young DJs in New York were going to be using their machines to sample records. If they had known that, it would have been in the manual. Yeah. It wasn't in the manual.
Yeah.
They were built to record a voice or record a guitar strum or a trumpet blast. It wasn't to record James Brown loops.
Yeah, and so, and also the other thing is that now you have elements then are being pre-produced, but still those pre-produced elements are still then being brought into a live DJ atmosphere.
Yes.
In terms of presentation or performance, I guess is more accurate. Okay, so because you've now touched on the whole digital side of audio, maybe this is a good time to talk about, of course, I know this from reading your essay that the Technics 1200 is no longer manufactured, that they stopped manufacturing it in 2010, and it's in large part because of this movement to digital audio,
right?
So the sales dropped, basically. So I guess that's where I want to go next, because you are looking at how the tools and the technology is influencing DJ culture, and also in terms of the culture itself, but in terms of performance, and also in terms of creating and encouraging new musical genres. So here we have hip-hop is established, the turntable is seen as an authentic tool, and then we start to shift into the digital audio realm. What happens? What's replaced the turntable? Why did they stop manufacturing the Technics? I mean, I know it's because sales diminished, but tell us more.
Well, because of the turntable's popularity in hip-hop and also house music, which grew out of Chicago, that's another conversation, but was also very influential. The turntable and the Technics 1200 specifically was firmly established into DJ culture, and that if you didn't use the turntable, if you were using, you know, CD players, or if you're using anything other than the turntable, you weren't really DJing. And in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, there were CDJs that came out that where companies, Pioneer was one, where they introduced a deck. It wasn't a turntable, but it was designed to look and feel like a turntable, but you were basically playing CDs, and they had a jog wheel, a circular jog wheel that you could put your hand on and manipulate the CD.
So in much the same fashion that you would have treated a piece of vinyl.
Right. Yeah. And it just didn't go over. I mean, some people used it, but for, you know, the most of DJs worldwide, they laughed at it. It wasn't quote unquote authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until a technology by a company called Rane, R-A-N-E, they invented what was called Serato Final Scratch, or they just call it Serato for short. And what they did was they figured out a way to have the best of both worlds. They make these plates that look like records, and they place them on the turntable, and they feel and look like records. But what you're doing is your mixer, where that your turntables are hooked up to, the mixer goes into like a converter, then goes to your laptop or your computer. So you are playing your MP3s or WAV files off your computer. So it gives the DJ the best of both worlds. It allows them to still have that tactile feel of records, but now you don't have to bring, you know, 5-6 crates of records to the club anymore. You have your laptop, you have thousands of files.
With all the digital files, right?
Yeah, and it opens up, you know, the ability to remix. You know, you could like make your own tracks at home and then bring them to the club that night. You can do all sorts of stuff allows you to experiment and be unique. Mm. And whereas the records, you can do a lot. DJs throughout the years really took records a lot further than the original, you know, record 100 years ago of how to play them. But what Serato allows is you can record, make your own remixes and such at home, and then play them all that night. You couldn't have done that in the past unless you had your own personal vinyl cutter or something.
Right, right. And again, it's, you know, it's what you were talking about happened in the 80s. So again, it's this theme of pre-producing certain elements and then bringing it into the live performance.
Right, right.
Yeah.
The next technology that's really changing the game is called Ableton. And it's software that allows you, it takes that same aesthetic of taking bits and pieces of records, as big or as small as you want, and they're placed on a grid on your screen, basically. And then, but instead of using Ableton, the software with a turntable, you use it with pads. Like there's a hardware that comes along with it that allows you to trigger the sounds on the fly. It wouldn't have been able to have been popular without Serato kind of bridging the gap.
Right.
You know what I mean? So we've gone to the turntable, to using drum machines and samplers to pre-produce your music, to being able to digitally manipulate records or and by means of MP3 off your computer, to now using files that there can be as big or as small as you want, but that the whole aspect of doing things on the fly. No, that's just as much of DJ culture as the turntable was, is performing and playing records on the fly to accommodate whatever the crowd's reaction.
Right. So now no longer do you have to pre-produce the elements in a digital audio workstation, right? You don't have to do that pre-production, but Ableton allows you to do it in a live environment. And as you say, if your crowd is, you know, liking a particular tempo or a particular, you know, energy, then you can capitalize on that.
Yeah, because DJing has always been part performance. It's not just standing there and playing music. I mean, it can be, but I mean, that's boring. The performance element of DJing has always existed, and now the technologies that are available allow that performance to become more, this more variables. Right. There's more things that you can do, and the technology allows it. But it's, getting back to the essay for a second, it's about using the technology in new ways. So just like DJs were using the turntable in the 70s and 80s and the samplers and drum machines in the 80s and 90s in ways that they weren't designed, DJs now have to use Serato and Ableton and whatever comes next in new ways. You can't just flip open the manual. I mean, you'll learn how to use them, but fine. But if you want to really push the envelope, you're going to have to close the manual and turn off the radio and other influences and really, you know, bunker down in order to create something new.
Yeah, and it comes back to, I mean, your argument is that it's these tools themselves that then also, because of that experimentation, it's not only the experimentation with the tools, but it also then leads to new genres of music.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right? So maybe you can speak to that, and what I'd like to do, I know you have a track, so maybe you can speak to that, introduce the track, and then after the track we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about future.
Sure. I brought DJ A-Track. He's originally from Montreal. He now lives in New York. He's a popular DJ and producer. Originally a battle DJ, where he would go up on stage and mix and scratch. It was in live competitions. He's now made the transition to producer. And this track is called Tuna Melt. It's a remix by Grand Theft, another producer out of Montreal. And this is more representative of what's happening now.
It is. So yeah. When would this have been put out?
2012.
2012, okay, yeah. So it's quite recent. So, and would he be using then various technologies? So would he be using, do you know if he's using, for example, Ableton, or do you know what's going on behind the scenes?
I can't say for sure, but I picked this track because I just thought that it was representative of what's happening. And it's also a mixture of samples, old drum sounds, from old drum machines to synthesizers and synth sounds of new technology. It's a real kind of mix of blend and old, but also kind of pushing the boundaries.
Fantastic. Folks, I'm speaking with Neil Scobie, of course, about hip-hop, DJ culture, the tools that have taken us throughout history and that are continuing to change and shift the nature of the music today. Let's have a listen.
Tune the tune. but the tune the tune.
Welcome back to Be the Media, folks. And I'm talking with Neil Scobie. We've been talking about DJ culture and how technology has, the impacts that technology have had and how much it's changed how the art of DJing, you know, has been done over time, but also how it's affected musical genres. And that's, I think, where I'd like to come back in, Neil, because that's one of your arguments, certainly, is that the tools and the fact that they've been used with a lot of experimentation and in ways that weren't intended, you argue that what it's done is it's created a lot of musical hybrids, and that's one of the catalysts for that to happen.
Yeah, because if you look at history, I mean, you can make a strong argument that a popular music has been influenced by hip-hop and house music to the nth degree. Its handprints are all over pop stars now, as you know, like Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga. I mean, it's transcended its own early beginnings, and it's both types of music are global. And so what I'm saying is that just like those two styles of music, those two subgenres ended up influencing pop music, new forms of music that will come out from the technology will do the same. But I think what's different is that the turnover of new subgenres is going to be faster. And that's due to, you know, the World Wide Web and the exchange of information. Because that's what it boils down to. It's data, it's info, which is readily transmitted across the globe faster. So if I'm a kid in, say, Rio de Janeiro, and I'm hearing hip hop from New York, and I'm making music, that's going to affect what I make. And I will mix it with, you know, traditional Brazilian rhythms or whatnot. And I'm not just making this up. This exists. It's called Baile Funk, and it came out of the favelas, the ghettos, if you will, of Brazil. And it's an example of how music transfers from continent to continent, appropriated and mixed with whatever music is part of the landscape, and then sent back out into the world again.
So would you say that this is more about the World Wide Web and the data then that can be so easily shared? Is it more about that? Or what is the connection then to the tools of the DJ in terms of performance?
Well, I think the web is part of it because you can be exposed to more music this way. But as it relates to the technology such as Ableton, you can take smaller and smaller fragments of the music to mix it and reappropriate it. Whereas the samplers of the 1980s, you only had, say, 3 seconds. Whereas now, the software is so powerful that you can mix 100 songs together. I mean, that's how mashups came to be. Mm-hmm. For listeners who don't know what mashups are, they're basically lots and lots of songs all mixed together at the same time, usually popular songs. So somebody will take like a Nirvana riff and mix it with Beyonce singing, mixed with 50 Cent rapping, mixed with the Beatles, and on and on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. That was only possible through the technology available.
Right. So then where's the future? If we're thinking about the future, where do you see the technology and experimentation going?
Well, I see more and more subgenres of music coming and going, although some will stick. Whereas hip-hop and house had these gestation periods of like 10, 15 years in the New York and Chicago, respectively, I believe that new subgenres from around the world will come and go faster because the information, and when I say information, I'm talking about the bits and bytes of the music, is transferred faster. And so this is just a prediction, but I just think that new subgenres will just come and go faster. But I think some will stick. Some will make like an impression. One, for example, would be dubstep, which is started out as a subgenre in England. And it wasn't born from nothing. It came from previous styles of music before it. But it has lasted, and it's now kind of transcended into popular music. Artists like Skrillex are known throughout the pop world now, although he's not a pop artist, but he's popular. Mm-hmm. You go on YouTube, he has, you know, a million plus hits on his videos.
And what is it then that makes a particular genre stick? I mean, why did dubstep stick?
dubstep's popular. I don't know what it is. I mean, there's sort of an unknown. Like, who knows how anything gets popular? Yeah. It's hard to say.
What is the tipping point? And right. How does that, with us for sure. But it's interesting to speculate.
Definitely. You know, yeah. Definitely.
And what about in terms of the tools and the technology that's upcoming? Can you foresee? I mean, you know, for example, not only is it easier through things like Ableton to take, you know, pieces of audio and do a mashup or to, you know, bring in a lot more and do it live, not only in a pre-produced way, but certainly there's a lot more tools for doing live visuals as well. So if we think about the future then, what do you see thing do you anticipate certain patterns or certain shifts in performance for DJ culture coming up?
Well, I think experimenting with visuals is something that's certainly it has happened. I saw a group, Cold Cut, from England about a decade ago start to experiment, and DJ Shadow has experimented with visuals, and so it's not new, but I think the ability to experiment more with visuals and perhaps maybe not have them planned out. Maybe not have like a backdrop and it's already kind of set where you want to do. Yeah. Maybe you could do visuals on the fly, like you're playing music on the fly.
That's right.
Or maybe, it comes down to the interaction with the audience. So if you could read the audience, which is a real skill for DJs, is being able to read the crowd and perhaps adjust your visuals to the audience's reception, just like you would do so with the music that you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be pretty interesting as well. But I just, as far as the technology goes, I just think that it is going to allow DJs to just experiment more. The more that you have in front of you, the more availability to manipulate the music, the more variables appear. And I just think it's interesting. It's fascinating.
It's exciting.
You know, I mean, when you go back in history, it started with the drum, right? And I mean, there's so much you can do with it, but I mean, it was a powerful instrument. You start with the voice and you start with the drum. And now we're at this point where we just have so many options. So we just really have to use our brains, you know, and experiment. It's all about experimentation for me.
Yeah, no, and even as you say, I mean, it may be that it's not individual DJs anymore. Perhaps it's more of a team, right?
Yeah.
Where you have people breaking out, different people are doing the visuals, for example. Or it may be one person trying to wear all those hats simultaneously. So,
right.
Yeah, the options are endless.
Yeah, it's exciting. I think it's exciting.
Neil Scobie, thanks so much.
Thanks,
Marianne. It's been great.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks for being on Be The Media, as you are weekly. Neil, take us out. I know you've got another track set up.
Sure. This is a gentleman by the name of Diplo. He's in the same camp as A-Track. They've collaborated together. This is a remix he did of an Australian artist named Sia called Clap Your Hands.
And just a quick thanks to Neil Scobie, Dimitri Demirs for being on the show, Emily Post, and I'm Marianne Vanderzon. Have a great week, folks. Clap. Be the Media is brought to you by the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at VIU.
How does that grab you?